Sounds like Bigfoot's coming onto the show tonight. I hear Bigfoot. Oh, there's an Andromedan ship. That's a real deal. That's what they sound like. Now we get a Moog synthesizer here. Oh, yeah. From Andromeda with Love. Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show, occurring after Christmas, year 2005.
It's time we, the Rishis, move from your Bigfoot to tomorrow's mysteries. Our message lies hidden deep within you. In this time, we, the Rishis, move from your Bigfoot.
Love, bud, deal, saxophone. Looks like I play that good.
Our message lies hidden deep within you.
Tonight's show is going to be some fun.
In this time, we the machine move from your big room.
I think you're going to enjoy it tonight. Song is called Rishi. I wrote it. Rishis came from the Pleiades. There's the Andromeda ship again. I love that tabla sound. Yeah, this is called Rishi. The Rishis came from the Pleiades. About 27,000 years ago now. The language of the Pleiades is much like Sanskrit in the fact that it's, how would you describe it? The sound of nature, the sound of water, the sound of the wind. You can feel the hot and the cold and the passion of the language. A little different than what we speak around here today. Of course, it's Michael Hamilton from Kenny Loggins' band. He's my lead guitar player. I just feel like I'm on a ship when I hear this opening. And I hope everybody had a good Christmas. I hope everybody had a really good Christmas. It was an exciting one around here. My kids flew in from England and we had a good time. And as I also had said just previous to Christmas, we're going to have a banging New Year. Well, hang on. We got the hologram going up in the vortex now. We installed two more projectors yesterday. The day before yesterday, actually, installed those. And we're going to have photographs on the amazing things that happen. We're going to be showing those up on BBS Radio and in the archives. We had a healing. Mother and my two kids came over, and there was an amazing healing that went on with her. She'd been in a car wreck. It wasn't her fault, where a person was actually killed. The guy hit him. His children ran into her in England, those funny little roads, and the man's wife was killed in this wreck. So she had some serious neck damage and was hospitalized for a long time, but she's now recovering. And some of the pictures of the recovery and the healing systems of Pyridine will be shown on our website, and you'll see the amazing photographs. Also bringing you up to date is the... We're actually seeing the seminar sign-ups go like crazy. Our seminar is going to be in May. Don't wait. Trust me, it will be full long before May. We can only have a certain capacity, and I can only do the light show here at the house and expose people to our systems. I'm limited by the amount of room that I've got, the amount of time that I have to give each and every person that attends the seminar some kind of a personalized attention. We got Dr. Ann West coming on board at Bog Radio or BBS Radio. Sean Morton and I are going to do a show in the very near future on remote viewing. We both done it. He gives seminars on it. You might even want to come to one of his California seminars or one in your area. So we got a lot going on here. That's just all there is to it. There's a lot going on this year. I think... 2005 for BBS Radio and myself and Don Newsom and the gang was the, and meeting some of the other people like Robbie, who I met, the psychic, and some of the other people that I've met now, bringing Lynn Horowitz on board. That was getting your feet wet. This year we're going to get serious. We've been fooling around. We've had a lot of technical problems. Unable to take callers, failure to give out phone numbers, questions not answered properly or quick enough. Many, many things that we're fixing, you know. So we're coming out of the repair mode now, and we're going into the fun zone. That's F-U-N zone. Fun zone. It's Italian. Fun zone. So we're coming into the fun zone. Well, tonight's show is going to be based off of my contact with Sannyasi. And it was a show that was done on my earlier Health Energy Science Radio show. It was done earlier. And it's a lot fresher when you hear the original version of it, because the actual contacts were actually happening when I did this show. So we're going to be getting Jim on the phone here momentarily. I'm sure he'll be available soon. And we're going to start the whole evening off with a bang, if I can remember how to get the bang going here. And I hope we're looking for Jim. Jim, are you around?
This is Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show, heard on your talk alternative, 93.5 KFOR.
Hi, Jim.
Dr. Bell?
No, thank you, Jim. I've had to think long and hard about what I'm about to do.
Okay, I'm going to turn the show over to you guys. I'm going to step back out of the time zone.
My own 10 years and ongoing experience with UFOs. It's not that I'm afraid to do it. It's just that, you know, on one hand, I'm saying to myself, you know, I don't want to be thought of as trying to prove something or gain any kind of recognition doing this. Because I'm going to explain step by step how I had an experience, how I began to have experiences. And I'm sure that by doing this, a lot of people out there are going to have the same experience. Because I'm going to open up some knowledge that heretofore has not been opened up on this planet. I know that. And it's going to cause a lot of tremendous positive changes. One of the questions that I get is, how did I get involved and why was I chosen? And because a lot of the sciences that I'm proficient in, the technology originated away from the Earth and came here and was transmitted to me by various encounters that I've had with these people in various locations around the world. And I think that if you really were to look at science and some of the experience of other scientists, they've had very similar experiences in their lives, you know. Like, for example, there's the first thing that was kind of strange for some people. It used to blow my parents out, and that was a thing that was called continuity of consciousness, meaning that I didn't forget my immediate last lifetime, where I was before I came to be born here on Earth. It's just as vivid and has remained as vivid, you know, the day before I was born, the day I was born, the day after I was born, even now, it's just as vivid, the conversations that took place. Nothing has changed. No amount of hypnosis or drugs or poisons or toxins or anything has ever changed that same steadfast feeling and knowledge that it was initially ingrained into me before I was born. And I believe that anyone has the ability to attain that level of consciousness merely by being truthful. I think that truth is the middle, truth is the beginning, and truth is the end of life. There are no intellectual ways to reach enlightenment. There are no nutritive ways to reach enlightenment. You have to be truthful with yourself. And I always admit to myself that if I were one of God's sons, I'm probably the worst one that he's got. But the fact is, I know that I'm a son of God, and I'm proud of it. But it also is a humbling experience, because I know that anything that I do against the universe is going to come back on me tenfold instantly, where some people that aren't quite as aware of what they're doing and their actions might have to wait a few hours or a few days or a few weeks. So these are the kinds of things that I was taught and felt as a child. I remember just before I was born, I was like having this conversation with the people that were around me saying, well, here I go. You know, it's like, you could imagine, you ever been back east where they have those emergency fire slides where you jump in a tunnel and you go down two stories in a black circular tunnel and you come out at the bottom and you're in the daylight again? Have you ever seen those things? They have them at the University of Michigan. That's where I used to play on them.
No, Dr. Bell, I don't think I've ever seen those.
Well, out here they have fire escapes that you go down the side of a building and they're in the open. But back east, because of the snow and the sleet and all of that, they have at various levels tunnels that you jump into that go down, you know, they go down the side of the building and you go down like two stories inside this tunnel, like on a slide, like something out of Disneyland. And when I was born, it reminded me of that, because I used to play on those as a kid. And I remember the feeling that it was different. Now, I remember this conversation that I had, and the people telling me that they would be joining me later on in life. At that time, I couldn't really relate to it, but it began to happen in about 1973. But anyhow, after that conversation I had with these people that I was with, I remember opening my eyes and looking up at the University of Michigan, where you're born, whatever they call that particular part of the hospital, the obstetric ward, and I was looking at four people, two men and two women in green smocks and green masks with those green hats on there, like sort of paper applied material for sanitation reasons. And I was looking up at them, and I was being delivered at that point, and I remember saying, oh no, you know, I know what the next part is like. And what was happening is, what was running through my mind at that time was, I was able to understand English and everything that was being said, everything that was going on, and I was totally powerless because this form that I was in could not respond to any of the mental stimulus that was going on in my mind. And then as I grew up, when I was about 2 years old, I used to play with the kids around me, and I enjoyed playing with the kids, but they were so easy to manipulate. And so as a result, I became very reclusive because I found myself having a tendency to manipulate kids. And this is the animal nature I was starting to fight at this time, the animal nature of my body. And what I would do is I would do bad things with kids. I would get them to do something bad and get a spanking for it, you know. And I would, for example, breaking a window or destroying something in the house. You know, I had this negative nature. I guess we all have to fight through that as a child. And I overcame that around 4 years old. When I was four, my mother started teaching me how to read. And, you know, because I didn't know how to really read at that time. I was learning how to read. I knew how to speak. I knew how to listen. And I knew how to understand what was being said. But the actual art of reading, I had to reintegrate my body. So this is the kind of childhood that I started out with. When I was about 6 years old, I was inventing lots of things. First thing I invented was little wooden men on little horses. Did you guys ever play with wooden men when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, we had army men.
Oh, little army men.
Little army, rubber army men.
Oh, yeah, you guys were into war already. We were into cowboys and Indians. We used to take lids off of coffee cans and punch holes in them and make little wagons, and then we would take clothes hangers and make little things over the top and then put cloth over and make little covered wagons. I used to use a cigar box, four coffee cans, lids, and then and a piece of cloth, like an old sheet or something, and make the neatest little covered wagons. We made little people and little everything you ever saw. Then I got into about 7 years old. I began to start building little boats, model boats that had motors in them, model airplanes, and I began to have dreams. All this time, I was dreaming, and every night I'd go to sleep and have the same dream. I was getting in a flying saucer, and I was flying all over the world, and that was my escape from reality at that time, I suppose. And I had these dreams up until I was about 16 years old, almost every night, the same dream. Then as I got older, I began to think about, you know, there must be, I used to stand out when we lived in Missouri, I used to stand out on the hillsides and look out into space and just hear these voices in the sky. I could just literally hear, it sounded like 1,000 different voices coming from the stars, and I could hear words from one constellation moving over to another. And it was just so easy to do, but to relate that to anyone, couldn't do it. Nobody could relate to it at all. Even some of the scientific geniuses that I started to work with when I was 14 at the University of Michigan couldn't relate to that aspect of life. They could relate to the possibility of extraterrestrials, but they couldn't relate. When it got right down home where it was a one-on-one for that kind of experience, people were afraid. I found that constantly appearing in my life, so I became very silent about it. When I went in the Air Force, I was stationed up by Northern California at Point Arena. This was when I was 17 years old, and I was about 18 when I got on my first assignment. I'd been to school for about a year and a half. And we began to, at Point Arena, watch these flying saucers drop. And at Point Arena, you've got to realize, is the furthest part of the western United States out to sea, which is in Northern California. So literally, we were on a peninsula out to sea in a very remote part of the ocean. And the water is very cold because the Aleutian currents are coming down from Alaska up there. And we were stationed on a mountain that's about 5,000 feet tall, which was very much exposed to the elements. And in those days, as even now, I was riding motorcycles. And, of course, riding those, it keeps your awareness on a constant, it keeps you very keen. Your perceptions are very up because you are one with the environment all the time. And so I was, as a matter of fact, even during then, I moved off the base and found an old log cabin. I was living in that in my off-duty hours. But my on-duty hours, I was constantly watching these spaceships drop from space And we used, at that time, we used four different kinds of radar sets. We had two types that were what were called height sets. One was an ANFPS-6 radar, which is a very powerful radar set that looked up to about 100,000 feet and about 20 miles out to sea. Then we had an ANFPS-26 radar, which looked up to about 150,000 feet and looked out to sea about 150 miles. That was the new radar made by General Electric that we were using. And these were called height sets, and they had a horizontally polarized beam that would look at an object dropping up, going up or down, and it would measure the distance and speed, elapsed time of ascending or descending, and that's what they were designed for. Then we had two other kinds of radars. One was called an ANFPS-8, which was a distance set. It was one that looked out how far away is the object and which way on the horizon is it going. Is it going north, south, east, or west? And so we would combine the height sets with the searching sets to get a perfect readout. This would be fed into a computer at Beale Air Force Station, which is located up north of Santa Rosa, California, and inland a little ways. Then we had a big radar, which was called an ANFPS-35, which had a 366-foot antenna on it, and 5 megawatts of power, 5 million watts of power. Now, you talk about radiation when you're working directly around a microwave, you know, oven, if you call it, 5 million watts. That's a lot of power to be around. This is the high-power environment that I was learning my early, you know, Air Force and military and science career in. So these UFOs would come down. They would come across the, it could come in towards California to about a distance of 20 miles offshore. Then they would accelerate at a lateral speed or horizontal speed about 5,000 miles an hour from Northern California somewhere down into Northern Mexico. Where then, when they got down into Mexico, they would make a left-hand turn and radar down there would pick them up and they would move off across the Atlantic Ocean. So this was the path that was pretty regular. And because of that, you know, we had a form. It was called a DDS Form 332 that we filled out. And this was a identification form for military people that were running radar sets to identify flying saucers. But the forms typically would go in the shredder. Nobody really wanted to know about that. It's sort of like the instance over at Pearl Harbor when the Japanese were coming in. Their airplanes were seen on radar, but nobody really paid attention to them because they'd never seen airplanes on radar coming from Japan before, so they couldn't therefore be there. And Pearl Harbor, of course, was the result. But this is the same thing here. So I spent, you know, some time in the Air Force, and I got away from it, and this UFO thing was building in me again. It was starting to build up. I was thinking about it more and more, but not all the time. But having, you know, most of my life been around this type of phenomenon, it was not new, but it was still undefined as far as I could remember, you know. So then I moved down here and started to work at Rockwell and worked with the Wernher von Braun for quite some time. We were working on the Saturn. And I began to, at that time, receive very faint telepathic contacts. As a matter of fact, I was reading a book by a guy by the name of Churchward and Harrington, I believe it was, about astral projection, because I'd had the experience a couple times unconsciously when I was a child. And I was trying to understand more about astral projection, and so I was reading this book, and it was very much written on a mental level. There was not much feeling going on in my body at that time as far as this went. I could just think it in thought. So until you develop feeling, those of you that have ever become contactees, it's very important to realize that the body is really the true thermometer of an experience, more than the mind. The mind typically is going to be deceptive until the body is well trained to the feeling, because the feeling of this kind of communication really begins it's a total body experience, not a mental thing that it could have happened or didn't happen. Those kinds of thoughts are really pretty much ego or thoughts of others that are just cast out there. So at this time I was very mental, but I had a definite contact about 1966, and I was working on the radar console. I didn't know who the contact was from or what it was from or even what it was, but I remember telling a couple of fairly skeptical engineers that there was going to be a UFO sighting at this NASA complex that I was working on, and I felt it would have something to do with the release of the first vehicle for the moon. Well, when the first Saturn rolled out, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning in the Seal Beach facility, a spaceship came to our facility. I was inside and didn't see it, but 400 people outside saw it. And you got to realize, during this time, I was working 12 hours a day on, 12 hours a day off, 365 days a year. That was my work schedule. We got one day off a year, and that was Christmas. And the reason we were working on this schedule is because our part of the defense contract and the aerospace contract was a year behind. So everybody else, all the other subcontractors like Douglas, Hughes and all of them, we're getting all their parts of the moon launch ready, but here we are with S2, which is the second stage of Saturn, a year behind, so we had to work on all the time. And so my shift at that time was between midnight and 12 o'clock noon. So at 4 o'clock in the morning, I always took a nap because I was burnt out. You know, after a year of that, you get tired. So I slept through this whole UFO encounter, although I understand that a few photographs were taken. And then they found out, you know, after this happened, a few people that had mentioned this to didn't consider me such an idiot after all, you know, because I was always condemned for bringing this subject up in professional circles. So that was the first incident that had any significance in my life where I actually had a prediction. So then things kind of died down for quite a while, and I went on and I began to study yoga practices. Yoga practices to me were quite a bit. I lost a lot of weight. I was very slim then. I went 7 years as a vegetarian, a year as a fruitarian, very strict diet, no alcohol, nothing. I was very, very clean. My body completely cleaned out. Went out on the desert, had an Indian ceremony with the Indians where they kind of run you through, you get large amounts of poisons put in your body. Basically, they have rattlesnakes by you in some of the ceremonies, and you're on a sacred mountain, and you go through this ordeal for about 3 days. So I went through that. The American Indians thought I was great, and they started studying with Tibetans, and they thought I was doing all right. I was like a cosmic student at this time, like I still am. So then I came back and began to form an encounter group because I knew there was more to this UFO thing than had met the eye. And one of the things that, one of the forms of yoga that I learned from the Tibetans, which is called a trispasso, in some of these new age consciousness classes that are being taught, like spoon bending and firewalking and that, they call it transfiguration. Are you familiar with any of those terms, Jim?
Well, I don't think so, not in the context you're using them.
Okay, this is where you ever get in a conversation with somebody and you look into their left eye and you find them looking back in your left eye?
No.
Well, try it. You know, when next time you talk to somebody, you know, one of the first forms of communication is whether the eyes wander or not. If the person is not telling the truth, they typically can't look at you. They have to look at the floor, the ceiling, the walls, and their eyes shift first. And you've probably seen people like that, right?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Well, try looking in the left eye, right in the left eye, and don't mistake it for the right eye. The left eye is the spiritual eye, and the right eye is the grounding eye in the body.
Now, we mean the left from your point of view, right?
Yeah, from my point of view, the left. And that would be assume yourself in the other person's position and from the left, their point of view.
So that would be a diagonally across from your left eye.
Right, right. And that's called a trispasso. When I worked with Lawrence Kennedy, we were doing that with transfiguration. And at the end, you just practice with people unconsciously. And if you'll notice when you're looking at their left eye, you know, and it gets brighter, it'll appear to get a little larger and a little bit brighter. That's telling you that person is moving toward the spiritual side of their nature in their life. Then if you don't see it getting brighter and you have a tendency to shift over and look at the person's right eye, if you find yourself kind of wandering to the other side of their body, And then it feels like you get a better communication when you look at the right eye, that person is not spiritually awakened yet. Doesn't mean whether they're good or bad. It means that they're still working in their mental nature and their physical nature more than their spiritual nature. And you'll find that everybody's eye has a polarity about it. And so I learned that one. So I always concentrate on the person's left eye unless I realize right away that I'm not getting feedback. Then I'll shift to the right eye. But I never look at both eyes, hardly ever. Because if you look at one eye or the other, it keeps your brain very active and it keeps you very communicative and you have a tendency less, you know, not to drift. When I was learning hypnosis, my hypnosis teachers used to tell me to look at the bridge of their nose. But, you know, I could see why they would have you look at the bridge of the nose. Preferably when I was younger learning hypnosis, I used to hypnotize like mass audiences and I used to hypnotize my whole senior class in high school, you know, I hit them all under one time. Even the teacher, one of the teachers. But what happens in hypnosis is because hypnosis is a pseudo action. It's not really in the truth. It's more in the world of emotion. And you look at the bridge of the nose so that you don't start giggling or something, you know, because people have a tendency to giggle if it's their first time. Because they feel good, but they don't know why, so they can't control their emotional energies that much. So, I personally don't even believe in hypnosis today. Once in a while, somebody will ask me to do a regression, but I won't do the regressions anymore unless I'm really forced to because I don't really feel it's of any importance. I believe that the past lives, the present, and the future is all in this very moment. And so for that reason, you really don't need to go back into the past to to search out yourself, because you're what you are now is what you've always been. And if you don't like what you are, you just have to say to yourself, I don't like this aspect of me, and I'm going to change instantly. And then instantly you can change, and you just have to hold that change, and that's a discipline. And holding that change is one of the things that I began to go through, because when I went through the beginning of my Indian and Tibetan ceremonies, I didn't like the person that I was. I was very dissatisfied with what I was as a person. I knew that I was of some intellectual stature, but I was very satisfied with my personality and my relationship with other beings. So in the process, we got into this thing called the Tsubasa. Now, the next step of it is to do what's called fire breathing. This is where the transfiguration begins to come. And this is now where you're not talking to somebody and unconsciously looking into their left eye. This is where you're consciously looking at someone. They're consciously looking back. Both of you know and are aware that you're looking into the left eye, and you just stare that way for 10 or 15 minutes. Now, you can practice with yourself in a mirror, but don't be alarmed that when you practice with yourself in a mirror, that you see some kind of a distorted face or a caveman face or a hairy face, or you might see a God face or a divine face. You'll see many, many different natures that's dormant within all of us. And the purpose is not to see how your face changes because of this, this rebounding of energy that's taking place. The purpose of that is to open up any kind of blockages, any psychic blockages in the 10th cranial nerve, any blockages throughout the whole psych system of the body, so that you become receptive to the true things that are at hand. So oftentimes we're storing up a lot of negative tensions, and this will release all of this. So once you practice with yourself in a mirror, some people will practice looking into a candle, just staring into a candle, and then having the mirror in the background, whatever it takes, or staring into a mirror with candlelight, and whatever it takes to release you from these inner tensions, it's very necessary so that you can begin to develop your mental capacities, your clairvoyant powers, your telepathic powers, because we all have this. The children that are coming into this planet will have to work through a lot less of this than we do, but we, because of our age and the time frame that we're in now, have to work through this. So I began to set up classes back about in the late 60s with people where they would physically come over to my house, sit down on the floor, and for 4 or 5 hours do heavy fire breathing and nothing but Tsubasa. And what we were doing then is we were working on the higher element of the human imagination, freeing ourselves of this bondage of these everyday mundane things. And everybody really enjoyed it. Matter of fact, it spread rather rapidly. A lot of people got involved with this. I saw some very, what I would call, straight orthodox people getting involved with this kind of thing. But finally, I took the cream of the crop of the classes, and I began a very one-on-one relationship. The kinds of people that I now had were high, what I would call high-level sensitives. One of them was a friend of mine that was a sitar player for Ravi Shankar in those days. So he was an American, and he'd worked with Rod Stewart and a lot of those people. But he was a very sensitive, high-level, musician. And he would, every morning, I would wake up in my house in Laguna, the other house I had on the hill. About 6 o'clock in the morning, I would smell this fresh fragrance of incense and hear the sitar playing. So that was the environment that we were living in at that time, a lot less stressful than the kind of environment that I'm personally into now. And we began to elevate our consciousness. Then what we did is in this class, we had a certain amount of what I would call sensitive women. So we began to balance off the people, the men, the male females, with the proper pairing and do the fire breathing with women. And this was the beginning of the what would later on lead to the contact with sannyasi.
So there you have the beginning of the Dr. Bell's Health Science and Energy Show, and we're going to continue on how all this came to be. Now, it's real interesting in the Tsubasa. When you're looking in somebody's left eye, you will go through what's called a transfiguration. And we sit in a lotus position facing each other with a candle. I even did it once in a typhoon with one of my friends. And with a candle, wouldn't even go out. You can hold your concentration strong enough in the eye to eye with your fire breathing, regardless of how much wind is in the area. If you do this outside a lot, the candle won't blow out. It will stay there for you permanently. So there's a tremendous amount of discipline that is required when you do this kind of stuff. And I, of course, enjoyed it immensely. Today, I don't have those. I wouldn't say I had my chops up as good as I did in those days, but still, it's very interesting how all that came to pass. With our systems technology, it came as a result of sannyasi's many, many visits. Gradually, we had to have our systems technology show up and appear to us.
was very important, I thought. And, of course, a lot of people out there today think that, too, and we're even stepping up a notch now, as a lot of you might be aware. So we're going to continue on now into the history of the Pleiades, how it we're going to start off in Greece, and we're going to look at some of the infrastructures that they used in those days in their temples and things like that. It's very important to not just think we're the only carriers of the light here with Pleiadian consciousness and technologies, but in fact, this has been going on for a long, long time. It's just been swept under the carpet by big business, government, big things that sweep things under the covers, which, unfortunately, a lot goes on. We're going to cue up Dr. Bell here some more. And I just love hearing Dr. Bell. It feels like a time ride, I guess you'd call it.
The next area of the Pleiadian connection was in Greece.
We're talking about the Pleiadians.
And the Greeks of prehistoric times had no written records of their ancestry and relied heavily on traditions and beliefs passed from generation to generation. In Greece, each city and tribe had their own protecting hero or demigod, and they were believed to have come to Greece from faraway lands. Many of them, they would think, would come from their homes in the stars. And many of the ancient Greek myths relate stories about the lives and adventures of great divinities. One tale talks about that Orion bragged to other heavenly beings that no man or animal could be his match. His strong boasting excited the anger of a god called Juno, who sent a scorpion to kill Orion with a single sting on the foot. It is a stretch, it's a stretch coincidence that the Pleiades, at certain angles of the night sky, takes on the form of a scorpion. The Pleiades were so important, this is really interesting, the Pleiades were so important to the Greek civilization that at least six temples were built, wholly oriented towards these stars. And from these temples, the stars of the gods were watched. And the Grecian temples were oriented, their first temple that I know about was built in 1530 B.C., and this was the temple of Athene in Acropolis. Then the Hecadamon of 1150 B.C. was the second temple. The Parathenon was built on the same site in 438 B.C. The temple of Bacchus in Athens was built in 1030 B.C. And the temple of the Aesculapium of Epidaurus was built in 1275 B.C. And the temple of Sunium was 845 B.C. And at some unknown date, perhaps contemporaneous with these Grecian structures, they were pictured in the New World on the walls of the Palatine Temple upon a blue background, and certainly were a well-known object in parts of Mexico, because in Cortez in 1519 found that there was a very ancient tradition of destruction of the world in some past age in their midnight culmination. So here were six temples built in Greece that all faced the Pleiades, all precisely oriented in a manner where they would place the Pleiades. Cortez had found out that there was a destruction of the world back, a few years ago during the Dark Age, and that's why it said their midnight culmination. So now, if you dig into history a little further, you can even see that the ancients said that the world had been destroyed before, and that's pretty much what happens. Is it kind of it repeats itself? Remember when Neven was digging down there in the Mexico, he found those three cities, one buried upon the other, and the oldest cities were like 25,000 years old. Now, locally here in America, in North America, of course, everybody I'm sure saw some of Steven Spielberg's films on UFOs, and of course we talk about the Devil's Tower. And according to the Devil's Tower is an American legend. We find the Pleiades were connected with Mado Tepe, or the Devil's Tower. The Indians call it Mado Tepe. And that particular formation looks like the giant tree stump, those of you that haven't seen it. It goes up 1,300 feet and in the northern plains of Wyoming. And according to the lore of the Kiowa, which is an Indian tribe, the tower was raised by the Great Spirit to protect the seven Indian maidens who were pursued by giant bears. The maidens were afterwards placed in the sky as a Pleiades cluster, and the marks of the bear's claws may be seen as the vertical striations on the side of the tower to this day. The Cheyenne Indians had a similar legend. So the Indians, of course, were very much into the Pleiadians, so it's not just by coincidence this is all taking place at this time. I mean, every civilization on the face of the earth has had some kind of experience. Now, down in Mexico City, at the sacred site of Tico Hukan, some 28 miles north of Mexico City, there is a west face of the Great Pyramid of the Sun is oriented to the setting of the Pleiades, and that 11 of the west running streets of the city point to the same spot on the horizon. These structures are even more ancient than the Aztec or Toltec culture, by the way. And down in the Caribbean islands, the Pleiades are considered to be the location of the center of the creator of the universe, where God lives, in the exact center of heaven, and the location of the God's house by the Kunas, as well as other tribes scattered throughout that part of the world. The Kunas say that the Pleiades are the soul of God in the secrets of the Kuna Earth Mother by Clyde Keeler. There was a quotation that was made. It says, it seems as though there is a constant struggle going on in the sky between the people of light and goodness and the people of darkness and evil. Iwan Titipi, in describing certain celestial bodies, referred to this battle. He spoke of the Pleiades as seven heroes who are arrow makers who prepare fiery shafts for the battle. At other times, the Pleiades are the soul of God where God lives. Now, even in our own book of Job in the Bible, there's a quotation about the Pleiades. And it's pretty fascinating. There's many, many, many quotations that I've dug up from many, many different astronomers. Now, getting into holistic health just for a second, you know, I'm talking about the origin of holistic health. There was a guy called the Yellow Emperor of China. His name was Hung Tai. He lived approximately 2697 to 2587 B.C., and he's considered by many of the Taoists to be a miraculous being who succeeded in attaining immortality. During his reign, utensils of wood, clay, and metal were manufactured. Boats and carts were constructed and utilized, and the medium of currency was originated. Provinces of the vast country were mapped. Acupressure and acupuncture became sciences. The emperor is generally acknowledged as the father of holistic medicine. And Hung Tai himself claimed that much of his rapid development began because of conversations held in court with his consultants, which supposedly were beings from the Pleiades. So the Hopi Indians called him, they named the Pleiades himself Chu Ho Khan, meaning those who cling together. And they too consider themselves direct descendants of the inhabitants of the Pleiades. The Hopi, as well as the Navajo and several other cultures throughout the world, used a calendar to allow them to chart the seasons, special events, with a very good form, you know, they were very accurate calendars. And the system they used was based on a 260-day sacred round, or minor cycle, and a 365-day year, a major cycle, which equaled a period between the midnight culminations of the Pleiades. And any day calculated on these cycles could not repeat itself for 18,980 days, or 52 years. And in the Kiva of Mesas, the sacred temple of the Mesas, the Hopi ceremoniously light the new fire. And this occurs every 52 years when the temple's sacred points align with the stars. Chu Ho Khan, that's what they call them. All fires are extinguished throughout the nation and rekindled from a sacred fire produced by the holy men. And the young men of the tribe learn the importance of the Pleiades early in life, for initiation in the spiritual ways takes place only when the cherished cluster is directly overhead at night. Remember when you came down here, Jim, to the house that time?
Yes.
You saw those candles burning here?
Yes.
Well, they're tied into that that system that we're just discussing now, and they have a tremendous amount of power. We have a certain area in our home where candles are never extinguished. They burn 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and have for over 10 years in the same position, never gone out. So it's a discipline, but at the same time, in enforcing that discipline causes your consciousness to constantly elevate and proceed forward. You don't really go backwards with those kinds of disciplines. And so, I mean, the Indians were just totally into this. Practically every tribe, for example, the Iroquois believe the twinkling orbs represent seven young people who guard the holy seed throughout the night, and they have prayers for happiness addressing them. Well, in 1980, when Billy Myers was becoming well-known, there was this huge exodus of all these Indian chiefs. They all went to Kansas and Zurich, where he lived, and tribal leaders and medicine men came all over the United States. They caught word of what was going on with Billy Myers over in Switzerland, and they all went over there. And they all came and congratulated him for his courage, and they all were comparing the histories of the Indians versus what the Pleiadians were then revealing to Billy. So it was quite a thing that was happening, you know, back a few years ago, and still ongoing, you know. And the first 68 contacts that were made when Billy Meyer started working with Sumyasi, they were all between her and Billy Meyer. And he's just a simple little farmer that's kind of hung out over in Europe most of his life. He's been to some Tibetan temples and that. And I'll read a statement here that Sumyasi made about the contacts, because people would always ask, why can't I get involved, you know? And she said, if we decide to come in contact with an Earth human, and the contact is to be continued for a long period of time, we must first study that individual for a full decade. This is done for safety of all concerned, as he must be able to recognize the truth, for the truth shall give him the necessary balance in his attitudes. And I know that what she's talking about, when she says that, because Billy had some problems, and both of us have had some problems with it, because it's such an euphoric experience when it's happening. It does have a tendency to throw you off balance when you come back into the real world that we live in here. So anyhow, we've been talking a lot about this contact thing that I've been involved with for the last, well, let's see, 14 years of my life now. And in the process of doing that, I've had some pretty good experiences, quite interesting to say the least. And they've been one of the most controversial things that's ever taken place, this whole situation that I've been involved with and a few other people around me. If you come down the Laguna Canyon Freeway, okay, it's close encounters of the third kind all the way down. My first experience in that was I was coming down the Laguna Canyon Freeway one night. You know, you've been down there, right? You've been down it at night?
Not at night, but I know exactly what you mean. It's the kind of area where you're going to have an encounter eventually.
Yeah, and, you know, this was a ways back, and it wasn't, I don't know what the encounter was. It wasn't the Pleiadian experience, but I'm driving down the canyon. I've got this girl named Melanie Martin with me, who's a ballet dancer, and she's half dozing off, and I'm driving a van. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I had to pick her up in Santa Monica after work, and she's coming down with me to spend the weekend. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like the full moon comes up, and this is when there's no full moon. The whole canyon lights up. And when this canyon lit up, and this huge disc came alongside of us on the left-hand side of the truck, she didn't see it directly, but she saw the flash. It was so bright that it woke her up from her sleep. She was like dozing off, 2 o'clock in the morning, driving for 2 hours, you know, from Santa Monica to put anybody to sleep. She woke up, and this disc came alongside of us, just like the moon. It looked like exactly like the moon, with the exception that it followed me for about a half a mile and then exploded and went straight up, you know. And this is back about 6 months before the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out. So I came on home, and I have you saw those keyboards. You know, I'm a musician, right? I've been playing all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, this keyboard set up, the pool table that you saw down there in the sound studio wasn't there, and it was just a sound studio. As a matter of fact, the whole room then was console. I had this huge console. I had keyboard instruments hanging everywhere, from the ceiling even, on a big specially designed platform, which isn't there anymore. I sat down and started playing music, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning by the time I got home. And I recorded it, and I still have the recording, and someday I'll play this recording for you. I just felt this musical urge, and I played this silly thing, this da-dum, da-da-da-dum. You know, it was this ascending thing that was not, it was like the opposite of an arpeggio. An arpeggio is a descending keyboard maneuver that's very beautiful, very flowing. It's like stair steps. This was the opposite. It was the stair steps going up in sound. I recorded it. I had two witnesses. I had Melanie and a girl that I was living with at the time, Louise, both there while I played it. 6 months later, when Spielberg comes out with Close Encounters of the Third Kind, remember when they're on top of the peak
Devil's
with the UFOs
Tower.
Coming in?
Devil's Tower.
Devil's Tower, right. Well, when they're on top of Devil's Tower, they're playing this music. Remember that? The guy gets a synthesizer, starts playing it, which then the spaceship responds.
Of course.
Yeah. I recorded that. I have it, the same soundtrack, 6 months before I didn't know the movie was being made then. You know, those of you that are out there, I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I just knew this thing happened. I wasn't trying to prove anything about it. I never did anything with the music or the soundtrack. But the fact is, I did it 6 months before the movie even came out.
Well, what is becoming more and more apparent with the UFO is that it's not just a nuts and bolts situation. There is a lot of psychic phenomena associated with it.
Well, you know, it was totally psychic for me. Anyhow, Rowena was driving the car, and I'm sitting there as a passenger, right? And this is about, what, two and a half weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago. I think it was before we went to Hawaii. And she's driving the car, and I look off to the right, coming down Laguna Canyon, and this big bright flash is there. Well, the first thing that I say to myself, well, you know, the way this canyon twists around, it could either be Jupiter or Venus. More than likely it's Jupiter, because Jupiter is very predominant right now below the moon at night. As a matter of fact, we take my telescope out at night and look at it. So I'm saying to myself, we're twisting it around in the canyon, and this is Jupiter. But I'll go ahead and look at it anyway. So then I stare at it again, and you realize it's casual. You know, it's not like I'm expecting anything, okay? So then I say, but it gets a little more intense. It starts to get a little brighter. Now I say, oh, I'm looking at the Orange County Airport. And this is how my mind works, right? I'm looking towards the Orange County Airport, which is straight across the canyon. So I live in the canyon, about 5 miles from the Orange County Airport. I says, well, there's an airliner coming in on what's called a delayed flight path, meaning that the traffic pattern is busy, and they have an outside pattern that just comes out to the edge of the canyon. So I'm looking at the rotating beacon of probably a 737 Air Cal jet, right? And I said, that's what that is, you know? And this is how I think, you know? I'm so skeptical of my own self. And this is the scientist in me, you know? And then it gets brighter and brighter, you know? And then I say, well, you know, this plane is really getting bright, and it's getting really close. It should be turning, you know, for its downwind leg, even if it's on an extended path. About that time, it starts to accelerate towards the car. And I realize I'm watching this thing for a minute and a half get brighter, winding through the canyon, and suddenly it's accelerating me. In 10 seconds, it's upon the car. It's brilliant, and it flashes off, and it's the outline of a beam ship. And a beam ship has a particular outline. It's in the Pleiades book, and it was Semyonsky. And I only knew after like a minute and a half, which is like eternity. I get 10 seconds of the total impact of what's happening, and it's gone. It's just totally. As just as I realized what it was, the moment I realized it, I made a comment to Rowena. It was gone. It was history. And, you know, that's what I call teasing. You know what I mean? But at the same time, the message was, always be on guard. Always keep yourself in the state to be receptive to that energy. Anyhow, 1 year at Christmas in 1980, Semyonsky told me that she would give me a Christmas present. And she told me on Christmas Day that the present would be, for the first time, a close encounter with friends, and to tell my best friends that I considered to be of worthy to go out and have this experience to come at a certain point here in Laguna. So we're having a Christmas party up in Los Angeles in Bel Air at a friend's house, and I grabbed some of my friends from up there and here, and we got in a motorhome, and we went down to this mountain that's on the backside of where I live now. And the mountains from... We were about 2,100 to 2,200 feet high on a mountain that kind of went out by its own. There was no residences really nearby. You had to walk maybe an eighth of a mile away from the last home. And so the view was down towards San Diego, primarily across literally millions of acres of vacant land that constitutes that marine base down in San Diego, starting with the outside of the El Toro base over here. And she came in with what was called a Variation 4 beam ship and proceeded to, oh, I'd say she stopped about probably at 2,000 feet, maybe 3,000 feet over the ground and approximately 2 miles away. And I asked her, you know, telepathically why she was so far away, and she said because they were going to demonstrate the propulsion system of the craft and it would be hazardous to be too close to it because of the electrostatic charges. And I asked her, what about your radar? Aren't you going to be seen on radar? And she says, no, because it's 1 o'clock in the morning, Christmas night. She says, every single person on the radar set, they're not watching their radar scopes at this time, because this is a time when the military forces just aren't paying attention to details because it's a holiday and it's a sacred holiday. So I asked her all these questions, and then she proceeded to do what's called a punch out. And that's where the ship accelerated at a vertical speed of about 18,000 some odd miles an hour, which is just right around the escape velocity, from a point of about a mile high straight out into space. And she did this three times, and each time it would take about 15, it was actually about a minute and a half interval, and the ship would go straight up in about, I would say, about 4 seconds. It would be probably 100 miles out there. It was way out there, and then it would accelerate back down. And as it came down, took about a minute and a half the way it would fall, And it was like if you drop an oak leaf, you know how an oak leaf will kind of float back and forth. So it came back. But the spectacular thing about it was when it went up, it produced a curtain of light like the aura or a borealis. And so you would see this mushrooming, a series of mushroom lights, and the whole quadrant, I'd say a whole quadrant, like 1/8 of the sky was lit up. And that, she explained that this was a negative ionizing effect created by the propulsion system of the ship. And the negative ionizing effect was actually healing the atmosphere of pollutants in a large sector. And I asked her, I said, well, why don't you bring more ships in here and clean up the atmosphere for all of us? And she says, we can't, because if the way the Earth human responds, if they were to do that, what would happen is they would have a tendency to make it even dirtier, not respecting what was going on. So I totally agreed with that. So she did this three different times. And then left, and of course the people that I was with at the time were flabbergasted because I told them during the day what time and where and what the event was going to be, and it actually happened. So this is one of the times that I told people, witnesses, that this event in fact would happen and when. So that gave a lot of credibility to the actual event. And everybody, I mean, the experience was so high and the feeling was so good because of the feeling the ship left that, I mean, people talked about it around here for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I talked to Lee Elders. This is when Lee Elders and I were just getting to know each other. Lee Elders is the president of Intercept, this company over in Phoenix that produced these Pleiades books. There's three or four of them that they produce. And he and his wife, Britt, had a similar experience over in Switzerland with Billy Myers one evening where they had made the same exact demonstration. And that was only two of those kinds of demonstrations that in all of a series of contacts that anybody knew that ever happened. One that was done in the United States and the one that was done over there. And so I thought that was kind of neat, you know. And another thing that Semyasi said, this is a quotation to Billy Myers, is in the course of our duties, we do here and there approach denizens of various worlds, select some individuals, and communicate with them. This we do only when a race is in a higher state of evolution. Then we explain to them that they are not the only thinking beings in the universe. So these are actual quotations of some of the things that she's actually revealed to him over a period of time.
So there you have some early encounters that I had. In the early days, I used to call those the glory days. What a lot of fun that was. So I hope you enjoyed the show here tonight. It was exciting to say the least. And the seminar will be coming up momentarily. If you want to get in on that, I do think that this year we are going to start having some more contact. I haven't had any physical stuff like we just described now in quite a few years. I've seen a shit here or there, but nothing really solid. But now, I do feel that some action will start happening again. We are now, of course, well into almost 30 years of technology since those days. That recording, that was about 1983 or 84, when we heard that, and that experience, of course, happened in 1981. And the people still talk about it today. And we had a similar experience up in Aspen, Colorado, just a few months after that. Later on in the year, that was Christmas, and I believe it was somewhere around February or so we were up there. And I think some of those pictures are posted up on the Dr. Fred Bell's informative site on BBS Radio under the archives. And we're going to have some more postings up there very soon of things to talk about. And you can, of course, go to our website, which is www.pyradyne, that's spelled PYRADYNE.com. You can also call us on the 800 number for more information. It's 1-800-729-2603. So there's a lot, 1-800-729-2603. There's a lot going on this year where we're bringing this consciousness to the world finally. I'm excited about it. It's been a long time coming, and hopefully I will begin the construction of the first prototype of the X1 healing machine. Of course, we aren't going to be calling that. We also look forward to starting our testing over at the University of California, Irvine here in the next month or so on the nuclear receptor for the Food and Drug Administration approval for a medical claim. We're very close to that. There's too going on with the receptor not to do these tests now, and some tests on the pyramid shape have already been done by the government and accepted, so they are starting to gradually, I guess probably by sheer overwhelm, have to realize that there is something to shape energy. It's not a drug or a pill. And so those kinds of things used to be called nuisance items, now are becoming new essence or nuance items, I do believe. So that's how that goes. I'm also going to be starting the late show with Dr. Bell, and that's going to be archives of old seminars. I'll try to put that together in a organized manner where it'll have some continuity. We'll lack the board. Obviously, there's a lot of, when I'm talking and doing a seminar, I often have the board there, the chalkboard, so you won't have that. But you can go into the Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light book, and just about every, you know, just go into the chapter that has the essence of the seminar that you're listening to on the Late Late Show with Dr. Bell. And on that show, you'll be able to pick up rather quickly the drawings that are necessary. And everything I ever drew on a bulletin board, you know, a blackboard rather, in seminars, pretty much produced much more illegible in the Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light book. So I hope everybody out there had a really cool holiday, you know. It's really necessary to have those. It's cool holidays. And we're going to take the show out here in about a second or two. And, I hope you enjoy this, and I hope you like the magic of the music that we're going to be continuously bringing to you this year. Hopefully I'll get some new albums out, or maybe one started anyway, some new sounds. I've got a lot of great sounds in my head, but I just haven't got them out to the people yet. So we're working on all that stuff. It takes time. And I love this song. Rishi. Till later, have a good evening.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.